The Police Federation official podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Police Federation official podcast. This is your opportunity as members to put questions and issues to the National Chairman and a variety of guests over the coming months. Expect some robust discussions and some straightforward answers. 2019, of course, marks 100 years since the Federation began, and lots of issues and topics to talk about, which the Federation, of course, want to share with you, the membership. Everything from pensions to pay, campaigns to conduct will be on the agenda over the coming months. I should also remind you as well, you can send in questions anytime via Twitter or email, and we'll try and include as many as we can over future episodes. On the programme, of course, is your chairman, the National Chair of the Police Federation, John Apter. Good to see you again, John.
Hello, Ian. Good to be here.
We're joined in this episode by Phil Matthews, Conduct and Performance Lead. Hello to you, Phil.
Good afternoon, Ian.
Good to see you. Just before we get into the meat, if you like, of this episode, let's just talk about the other side, John, the other side of being the National Chairman of the Police Federation. We know that, you know, your desk, your in-tray is full of a lot of questions. It's full of a lot of issues. There's a tough old agenda to get through. But there is a sort of a lighter side, if that's the right way to put it, to this job.
Absolutely. I've said before, Ian, I'm in the most privileged position in policing. Really proud to be a police officer, although many of my mates will say I stopped being a police officer a long time ago. But for me, it's about the brilliant work that our Fed reps are doing and doing every day. Only this morning, I spoke to a couple of Fed reps who've saved people from resigning from the organisation, put welfare measures in place, which the officer who they were supporting didn't know was available, as well as many other things. But really good things which most of our members, thankfully, will never have to experience. And the other side of it, I've been working with the team, putting together the plans for this year's Bravery Awards, the Police Bravery Awards, which is just reading through some of those actions of our colleagues around the country is just breathtaking. It really is. And I think now and again in policing, when, you know, there's a lot of doom and gloom out there, but sometimes you have to take a step back and realise that there's so much good happening every day, and sometimes that's a bit overshadowed. So it's people like me who need to really shine a light, not ignoring the bad stuff, because it's important, but there's far more good going on than bad.
And it's interesting because you mentioned the Bravery Awards later this year, of course. I mean, having been to a couple of these myself, I mean, these are incredibly powerful moments. I mean, these show what the cutting edge of policing is really about. I mean, and these are, you know, your members are really putting themselves out there on you can't really say enough just how incredible some of those stories are when you see them.
Indeed, and certainly one thing I've always thought, and I know local forces will celebrate police bravery every day. I think nationally we can do more. I think the annual Police Bravery Awards are such an important date in the policing diary. They will stay, and it's important they do to celebrate that ultimate bravery and sometimes sacrifice. But we can do more in making sure that the public, the media, my colleagues see just how brave, courageous, dedicated our professional police officers are every day. And we need to celebrate that all the time, just one day.
Do you think all of your members are aware that you are a police officer as well?
No, I don't think they are, and certainly some of the conversations I've had with some would suggest that.
I think some people don't realise that, in fact, you know, the family of people in the Federation are also, you know, previous or actively serving police officers still.
Absolutely. I'm a police officer.
It's not funny, like you haven't been there.
No, I've seen it and done it. I've been in the job 26 years. I'm a Hampshire officer and I'm still a Hampshire officer. I'm accountable to my chief constable, Olivia Pinckney, who's the chief of Hampshire, and I have monthly one-to-ones with her. Trying to do my PDR is a bit interesting. You know, objective one, don't get arrested. Objective two, don't upset the Prime Minister. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I am a police officer and, you know, very proud to be as well.
Sure. We're going to look at a tricky issue here. And, of course, this comes up time and time again. The IOPC, misconduct hearings. I mean, Phil, just give us an idea then. Just explain in layman's terms, who are the IOPC? What is their role? Who are they answerable to? What do they do?
Right. Well, they've changed the name a few times over the years, but basically,
they're... Is this the 2019 name?
The 2019 name, yes. They are basically a body, a supposedly independent body that oversees complaints to do with the police service. So the Independent Office for Policing Conduct is what they're called at the moment. Previously the IPCC, Independent Police Complaints Commission, and they've changed guise a number of times before that. But basically they oversee complaints that are made about the police service in England and Wales, and can independently look at those should they choose to, and come to a decision as to what happens progression-wise with those complaints.
So what is that relationship between the Federation and the IOPC like then?
Well, it used to be non-existent with the IPCC before. It was very touch and go. We were at loggerheads with them over a number of different issues for a good number of years. I've got to say the relationships improved drastically since their change. We've got a new Director General, Michael Lockwood, who has arrived with no policing background or axe to grind, apparently, and he's actually listened to a lot of our complaints and what we've been saying to him. And I've got to say he's changed a lot of the way they do business. They still have a job to do, and we're not necessarily going to agree with them all the time. But they are at least willing to engage with us and listen to what we say. And they have actually changed some of the way they do business as a result of that. So I'm moderately encouraged. There's still a long way to go. And there's still quite a bit that we want to change with them. But they are at least listening now.
But you can still understand why a lot of officers are very cautious about this. Many feel that their entire kind of raison d'etre, their whole point of being a police officer, is often compromised because they're wondering what this huge organisation is going to make of a single complaint.
Yeah, and one single issue handled badly can wreck that relationship for years and years to come, and that's unfortunately the position we've arrived at due to the legacy of previous incarnations. I mean, I've been a Fed rep for the last 15 years. Majority of that has been involved in discipline work, defending my colleagues or representing them when they're accused of wrongdoing. And that's certainly been the thrust of majority of my Federation career, trying to assist members who are accused of wrongdoing. That's not always seen as trying to get them off, that's giving them the right advice. You know, we want rid of the wrong'uns as much as anybody else does. But the vast majority of complaints aren't founded in reality. And our members, because society asks them to be, we put them in conflict with the public, and then we hold them to account for doing what we ask them to do, which is unfair.
John, did you want to come back in?
Yeah, just really to reiterate the impact that investigations can have. And I know from bitter experience, many police officers become a rep for a number of reasons. A good chunk of them become a Fed rep because of the way they've been treated. And I, many years ago, I'd only been in the job a few years, I was investigated. I was arrested by my force for a matter which was investigated for over 18 months. Doesn't seem a long time now in what we're talking about, but 18 months of absolute hell. I did absolutely nothing wrong and received at the end of that a formal apology for the way that I'd been treated. But that really spurred me to do something about it. I was so close to resigning because I felt betrayed by the organisation I loved. But I decided to stick in. The advice of my Fed rep at the time was, make a difference. And this is what I think Phil plays down, the changes that he has been instrumental in bringing with that change of relationship. And I agree, Michael Lockwood, the new Director General of the IOPC, is a man who is listening. He's certainly changing the tone of that organisation, but there's a long, long way to go. But without our influence, that change wouldn't have been forthcoming. So we are making a difference, a positive difference. And if that helps officers or prevents them going through the hell that I went through and others, then that can only be a good thing.
So is this about sort of new disciplinary regulations and things like that?
Yeah, I've been campaigning with and dealing with the Home Office and the chiefs to try and change the discipline regime. I've been calling for a number of years since I've been a national rep for a move towards performance, because the majority, no one sets out to do a bad job. Majority of the time, our members do not come to work thinking, I know, I'll do something bad or naughty today. They make mistakes, they're human. We put them in really tough, difficult positions where we ask them to make split-second decisions that can have lifelong ramifications for people. And then we try and micro detail the way they've done things in freeze frame analysis over years afterwards. And we need to put that into proportion, and we need to deal with things. People make mistakes, and if they've made a mistake, then they should learn from it and become better officers and keep people in the job to make a difference to the public in the future. And the way to do that is to treat them compassionately, with some understanding for the position that they've been put in.
Just tell us a bit about this the whole thing of new discipline regulations kind of changing the emphasis from misconduct to performance. What is that? What's happening there?
Well, at the moment, we have a set of professional standards, professional behaviours that we have to adhere to. If you breach that in any way, shape or form, that is technically misconduct or gross misconduct if it's serious enough to lose your job over. Majority of those cases are performance issues. People haven't just... they haven't done things as well as they could have done for a whole variety of reasons. Sometimes because they haven't had training, sometimes because we're asking them to juggle too many plates, sometimes because they're acting in a split-second spur-of-the-moment reaction and they've not got it right, or they're not up to date on the latest legislation that's come out, for example. That doesn't make them bad, mad or dangerous. It just means that they're human. And so what we've been trying to do is we've been trying to get the system to recognise that. Before, it didn't recognise that and it treated everybody, well, you've made a mistake, therefore that's breached the standards, which means you have to be disciplined. And it shouldn't be about a sanction. It should be about improving the performance, not just of yourself, but the whole force moving forward so that the public get a better service. And we feel that that can be dealt with under a performance regime. And we've had agreement from both the chiefs and the Home Office, and that's the way forward. And for the last couple of years, we've been working on a way of doing that. And there's a completely new set of regulations that are going to be coming out. Unfortunately, they've been delayed a little bit because of Brexit and no secondary legislation's getting any parliamentary time. But that should be arriving towards the tail end of this year, or certainly by the beginning of next year now.
So scuppered by Brexit momentarily.
I was hoping that word wasn't going to be mentioned. Phil, yeah. You've got to put a pound in
you've
the swear box.
You've got to put a pound in the box, Phil. Sorry.
We don't allow that word in here.
I mean, in terms of, just to go back to the raw reality, John, when an officer is referred to the IOPC, the Federation are still there in this equation, aren't they?
Absolutely.
An officer isn't hung out to dry and left to just simply communicate with the IOPC. The Federation still have their back.
Absolutely. So you've got a whole host, hundreds of Fed reps across England and Wales who are there, trained to in different areas for that the Federation can offer advice. Misconduct is one. It could be equality. It can be health and safety, all sorts of arenas. And people will come into contact with Fed reps in a number of ways. So if they are served papers for misconduct, then most forces, I would hope, would encourage the officer to make contact with the Fed, or the officer would already. But we also have something called post-incident processes, so where there's maybe a death or serious injury following police contact, could be a shooting or a pursuit, or somebody, you know, dealt with an officer where police knocked on the front door, member of the public jumped out the back window and was seriously injured. They were trying to evade arrest. And the reps will be involved there to offer support. So absolutely, the Fed reps are very often the only people who will be there for them from the very start of the process until it's concluded. And a really important thing as well, especially for non-police listening to this, Ian, is this isn't about keeping corrupt police officers in the job. This is everybody's entitled to have the right support and representation. But I've been a rep, like Phil, for many years. I can count on one hand the amount of corrupt officers. And they are dealt with, and as long as they're dealt with professionally, proportionately and fairly, then they will be exited out of the organisation. But the vast majority of people we deal with, exactly as Phil says, they've done the best they can. But there's been a procedural error, or the member of the public has not been happy with the outcome, or circumstances completely out of the officer's control has taken over, which has landed them on the wrong side of an investigation. But it can be an incredibly lonely place, and the Federation are absolutely there when people find themselves in that place.
I mean, I guess on that point, Dave sent a tweet in on this. It says, why is the human element not considered more in an IOPC investigation?
Well, I think they're process driven, or they were. We have got them to think more of the human element, and we certainly think of the human element. I said the rep is there to provide the first line of support for the officer and their families, but we also have our welfare support programme that we refer people to, because there is a massive link between officer welfare and well-being and the length of time that they're under investigation for. The longer the investigation, the more mental health problems and issues that arise for the officer and their family and spouses and kids and everything.
Do you think previous to the IOPC, they'd not been aware enough about the fact that, you know, if you're suspending an officer, which could be, and we know in extreme cases, rare but extreme, it could be years.
I think
that is the point that Dave's mentioning here, isn't it? Human element.
Well, I think from their perspective, they are just purely there to, they've only focused on, has there been a breach of the standards, yes or no? Can we prove it? Can we get them to a hearing or a meeting? And that's what they've been focused on. Their job isn't the welfare of the member. But I think they're human beings, and they have realised that actually the way they do business and the length of time they take does have an effect. I mean, because it affects whether the officers go off sick, end up with depression, anxiety, and then they can't interview them because they're on happy tablets from the doctor because they're sat at home looking at the four walls going quietly mad. So that has been brought to the fore. But with the lack of officers at the moment, with forces under the current finances that they've got, just one or two members missing from a whole team can make a massive difference to an entire workforce. Particularly if you think of environments such as custody, where they deal with very mad, bad, dangerous individuals on a daily basis. If you take one or two key members of a team out, an investigation, or you restrict them, that has a massive knock-on effect to an entire force's ability to lock people up and deal with prisoners. So forces now, because of the financial strains, are seeing those cracks appear, and that's forcing forces particularly, but also the IOPC, into taking that into account. And I said, as a federation, we really push the welfare support programme, which we fund, to make sure that our members' well-being and their families is actually looked after in that process.
What I think would be helpful for many people, and certainly one of the reps put this forward as a question, would be the kind of simple practical advice for members who found themselves in a conduct or performance issue. What would you say to somebody who's right now listening to this, who discovered earlier today that they're in this very place? What do they do?
First things first, don't panic. Speak to your Fed. Speak to a rep as soon as possible. It might be embarrassing, or you might think it's embarrassing, or you don't want people to know about it. The Fed will keep your confidence, and the Fed rep will keep your confidence, and it won't be divulged unless it needs to be, because we need to get you a solicitor, or we need to refer you, to a welfare support programme or something like that. But they will keep your confidence. It won't be something that we haven't encountered before. So you've no need to, however personally embarrassing it might be, we need to get you the right advice. We are there to support the members and give them the right advice. I said, if somebody's done something bad, mad or dangerous, then, that the right advice might be plead guilty, you're going to prison. But we need to be able to give them that advice. But we will support the member, and we will support their families while we're doing that. And the big thing is, don't panic, seek advice early, and we will get you the right advice. And it won't be anything we haven't come across before.
Just add to that, Ian, if I can. I speak to a number of people who, for whatever reason, will not have contacted the Fed. And then things escalate pretty quickly. And what they will say to me is, I didn't want to trouble the Federation.
So they're Fed members, but they've not thought to go to their local rep.
And they'll say, well, this was just such a small issue. We would much rather somebody contact us and we'll talk through the issues, which might not go anywhere. But, they pay their subscription, they're entitled to that support. And we have reps who are really well trained. There's nothing, as Phil said, there's nothing that they've not encountered before. So please pick up the phone, contact your federation, your local federation.
And the vast majority of complaints don't end up going anywhere. Probably about 80% of them don't end up any further than, an explanation being given and it goes away. But cops are very resilient characters, and quite often they will try and deal with it in their own way, particularly if they don't want anyone to know about it. And I've seen a number of cases where people have tried to provide an explanation, but they've dug themselves a hole, and they end up being disciplined for something completely unrelated, because they've made a mistake or an error in the way that they've responded. So Please think before you respond. The temptation is to talk straight away or say something straight away to the investigator. Please seek advice first. You can repent at leisure.
So worth saying now then, Phil, about these new regs. I mean, what's there? What's going to be included?
Well, obviously, we've pushed that things should be treated more as performance. Actually, the chiefs have been good to their word. They are trying to get their professional standards departments to adopt the ethos of a performance culture before the regs have even come in and deal with things as a performance. But the main bits are there's going to be a new, it's called performance requiring improvement, but if you think of it in the old money, like a UPP, unsatisfactory performance procedures. So they're formalising what used to be management action, which will be outside of the discipline arena. So anything that doesn't warrant a final written warning or a written warning or losing your job should be dealt with as a performance matter moving forward. So you'll have a more structured, below discipline way of dealing with low level and complaints. And that could be by way of management action, some form of PDR, an action plan or an explanation or a meeting with the complainant, something of that nature that used to be dealt with like the old local resolution. Also, there's going to be changes to the meetings and hearings. We've got a longer period of a written warning and a final written warning for which will allow us to keep more officers rather than be dismissed, we hope. So where people have made mistakes, but they're quite serious ones, if it's not job-threatening, they could be under a final written warning for up to 5 years, which we hope will allow more people to stay in and learn and pass on that learning to their colleagues. There's also going to be a reduction in rank brought in, which is something that we weren't very keen on, but the Home Office wanted it brought back in. And there's a few other changes to do with the way that hearings are handled by the legally qualified chairs, which should make the process a lot fairer for our members and provide more consistency across the country.
And what about this, the time limit campaign? Does that do what it says on the tin?
Well, that's something that we're campaigning for at the moment. I mean, one of the massive concerns that our members raise with us all the time is, what are we doing about these lengthy investigations that go on for 5, 7, 10 years, and why aren't we tackling them? The problem we have is that there's a legal obligation on forces and the IOPC to investigate these matters. There's nothing in the regulations that says how quickly they can do that. It just says as soon as practicable. And the problem we have is that providing that they can show that something's been happening, as long as our member can still have a fair hearing, which is a subjective argument, there's very little we can do about the length of time that these cases take, which are blatantly unfair, cause widespread issues with our members' mental health and everything else. And cause problems for the force. But unless there's an effective, an end point, we're really tied as to what we can do about it. So we think that a 12-month limit is fair, it's just. If I stop you when you're driving your car, Ian, I've got, for a driving offence, I've got 6 months in which to raise a prosecution and take you to court. You as a member of the public can complain about me at any point. There's no time limit. And there is no time limit for how long the investigators can look into my conduct. It could be 10 years later. I mean, that can't be fair. That can't be just or proportionate. So we feel that there's got to be an end point. And that actually shouldn't prejudice the IOPC or PSDs. It should actually hopefully focus their attention onto those cases that are older, that do require the public scrutiny. And allow them to put the resources into those cases that need it.
It does seem extraordinary, John, doesn't it, that there is, at the moment, no time limit on this.
Yeah, it is.
This can just go on and on and on.
Absolutely.
A criminal investigation, other than exceptional financial fraud or one of those kind of cases, generally speaking, would not go on for a number of years.
No, and the impact is dramatic, not only on people's mental health, on their careers, on their family units. It really is a devastating thing to happen, and for it to be so prolonged. So I really am glad that we are behind this campaign. We're pushing it for all it's worth. And hopefully, because it's the right thing, hopefully we'll get a good result.
Here's a couple of questions. They do sort of tie in some of these. On conduct, Janaman says, how can we shift from a blame culture to a learning culture? It's been talked about, but no real progress has been made so far. What do you think of that?
Well, we've got the chiefs that lead on conduct and performance. So we've got Mr. Guildford, the Chief Constable of Nottinghamshire, who leads for conduct, and we've got Mr. Jelly, who's the Chief of Warwickshire, who has the overarching professional standards portfolio. Both of them have come out, along with the Minister for Policing, Mr. Hurd, and said, we want a performance culture, that we want you to deal with things, unless somebody's deliberately set out to do wrong, we want you to deal with it as a performance issue and get people to learn and improve moving forward. So they're behind us. We're trying to deliver that to the heads of professional standards around the country to try and get consistency. And unless somebody's deliberately set out to do something mad, bad or dangerous, they deserve a chance to improve. And that's basically how we've been progressing it so far. And the regulations and the Home Office guidance that will sit behind that should provide us with a legal framework to make sure that that happens moving forward.
Here's a general one on welfare, John, and this I think this came up on the last episode, just very briefly. Recent publicity over police suicides. These are terrible, terrible stories, of course. Can psychiatric evaluations or TRIM be compulsory rather than officers simply being offered it? I know we touched on it before, but it is worth talking about this again.
Yeah, I mean, and certainly for some of the specialist departments, and we have talked about this before, then absolutely it's the right thing to do. For general policing, I think there's an argument for mandatory psychological assessments, certainly when you're coming into the organisation, but things change. I don't want us to pin everything on these assessments. What I also want is to prevent people falling ill in the first place, but also the support that's in place to give colleagues that support they need. We've already mentioned about the welfare support program. This is we're in partnership with the Police Firearms Officers Association. We fund this without a shadow of a doubt. It saved lives. I would like to see us increase the level of funding to enhance the support we give. But that shouldn't be a let off for local occupational health departments. They need to do more. We're working with government, in particular the police minister, to have a national wellbeing service, which will hopefully, I'm confident, if what they're talking about is delivered, will make a real difference. So it's a much bigger issue than just the psychological evaluations. But yes, they are important, but they don't answer all of the problems we've got.
And here's a final one from Chuckles, favourite subject, industrial rights. I mean, this comes up a lot. It's amazing how many, from a journalist point of view, how many members of the public don't realise that you have no industrial rights in the conventional sense as police officers. That isn't an option to take industrial action. Chuckles asking, will we ever have a member vote on this issue?
Well, we've had one before, and there was an awful lot of anger about the way that was dealt with and conducted. And certainly the feedback I received, especially when I was going through the election process, was that people felt it was a skewed debate, a skewed vote, and it was always going to go the way that people at the Federation office here wanted it to go. So what I've pledged is let's have a sensible and meaningful and transparent debate on what industrial rights means. Because when I ask officers, and I do, they say, well, I really want the right to strike, but I'd never use it. This is not about the right to strike, because the chances are highly unlikely we would never have the right to strike. This is about employment rights and how they can be used against you or to support you. It's important that before we have any vote, that members really understand what that means. I've made a pledge that we will have that debate, and we will. If that leads on to a vote, then that's fine, if that's what the members want. But yes, I've promised there's going to be a debate, and there will be.
And just a very final point, John. I mean, in terms of the shape of policing at the moment, you've not pulled any punches on your thoughts of the Prime Minister's position and the Prime Minister's position previously as Home Secretary. I know that you've talked very robustly to the current Home Secretary about all of this. Is there any movement now? You know, we know that the police have lost a significant amount of manpower over the last few years. It's clearly had an effect, demonstrably had an effect. Is the mood music changing at all on that from government, do you think?
But it is changing in a positive way, but not quickly enough. And it is all about money. And if you look at the way that the funding has been announced, the latest set of funding, and look, Ian, I don't agree with it all, but it's better than we had. Because as well as plugging part of the pension gap for local forces, the government also gave local police and crime commissioners the ability to increase local precept. Now, I have a real issue with passing the buck to local police and crime commissioners because that's, I believe, absolving their responsibility, the government's responsibility for properly funding policing. But I think we need to have a discussion about how policing is going to be funded, because certainly what the Home Secretary is telling me is this is the future of police funding. But we now have most police and crime commissioners who are increasing local tax. My plea...
They've been given more wiggle room there.
Yeah, they've been given... So they can raise it by about £24 a year. But there's so many complexities to that because that's based on a Band D property. So we're in Surrey at the moment. So a Band D property in Surrey will attract far more money than maybe an inner city area because there's more Band D properties in this county. But my plea to PCCs, and it's for the public to hold their feet to the fire, if they do increase local taxation, the public have got to see something for that. We don't want that money used for back office projects or people's pet projects. It's got to go into frontline policing. The public should rightly demand that and expect that. So if this is the model of policing and police funding going forward, the local police and crime commissioners must be very transparent how that money's going to be spent.
Okay. John, thank you. We will see you on the next episode. Phil, thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
We will speak again soon on this issue. That is it from this episode. A reminder that if you've got a question you want to put to John on the next episode, then make sure you follow the Police Federation on Twitter. You can also email a question in as well. Again, we'll try and cover as many issues as possible. Use the hashtag to AskFed. And of course, the email address is communications@polfed.org. And if you are listening to this podcast, make sure you hit the subscribe button now, which means you'll get each episode automatically. And of course, you can, of course, listen via the Federation website too. Until the next one, goodbye.